Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Founders Club Radio.
Welcome to the Founders Club, where each week we talk to the founders and leaders of great private companies. I'm your host, John Coffin, and this morning I'm joined in the studio by Scott Ellison, the co-founder and CEO of East West Manufacturing, and Mac Neese, the founder and president of Neese, Lagana, Eden, and Cully, Inc. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Morning.
Mac, I'm going to start with you. Tell us a little about your firm and what you guys do.
All right. Well, we are a life insurance advisory firm. We are very focused, and we only advise and participate in plans revolving life insurance. No other kind of insurance. We started the firm 28 years ago. The four principals of the firm now have approximately 150 years of business experience. And when we started the firm, we did so because there was no one who was doing what we thought needed to be done. There were investment advisors, there were legal advisors, there were tax advisors, but there was really no such thing as a life insurance advisor. Lots of life insurance salespeople employed by a company, some life insurance brokers, which meant they use products with three or four different companies, but nobody who represented the affluent client or the large privately held business. And what we decided is we wanted to be the best life insurance buyers in America. We wanted to be able to design and buy product for our clients rather than try to sell something that was on the street. We thought that the affluent marketplace deserved a different pricing pattern. They had characteristics which were at least common sense, easy to identify. If you spend much time working with actuaries and underwriters, you know common sense doesn't make any sense to them. It's all fact. So when we would say we think very wealthy people live longer because they take better care of themselves, we know they buy larger policies, and you price policies on a unit cost basis. A $1 million policy costs 10 times what a $100,000 policy costs. But it doesn't cost 10 times as much to administer or underwrite, and therefore it shouldn't cost 10 times as much. Frankly, to make the story very truthful, we went around the country for about 2 years talking to major life insurance companies and didn't get very far.
This was in the late 80s?
This would have been
early 90s?
35 years ago, okay. So early
yeah.
80s.
Yeah.
And the major cost for large life insurance companies is a distribution system.
Sure.
Very high turnover rate, pyramiding, pay type system, like an Amway system. You know, the salesman right. makes something, somebody else makes something, somebody else makes something. And we thought there were a lot of layers of cost in there that could be removed. To end the story with success, we finally found someone to do it. Then we found two people to do it. Then we found five people to do it. And now we have a basically proprietary product with about 10 major life insurance companies. So that's what we do. And we have been together now 28 years. And represent some of the largest companies in America, some of the wealthiest families in America, some of the largest privately held companies in America. And it's fun.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really a fun thing to do.
You talked about the difference between institutional pricing and retail pricing. How have you really, as the advisor, developed that? It sounds like you've developed that market for institutional pricing to a certain extent.
We do, and it's you know, we can't do it by ourselves. I mean, we have to get a carrier to participate.
Right.
But now after our founding group being some 30, 35 years old, we have 30 to 35 years of history. So we can go to an insurance company and say, if you take your statistical mortality results and compare them with ours, you will see that there is a 20-25% difference.
Mm-hmm.
Insurance companies are going to make a certain profit on products they sell. But if you say, let's just say that number is 8%. So if we say to you, John, we're willing for you to make 8%, but you can make 8% by participating with our clientele for a product that's 20% cheaper than your retail product. So we're smart enough not to go to an insurance company and try to take money out of their pocket. That's not going to work.
Right.
But if we can find a way to legitimately say, we can help you develop a product for our clientele, which is much more efficient. And you'll make the same amount of money.
Yeah. So. Affluent families, and business owners oftentimes have this transitional concerns in place. And oftentimes there are legal elements of that, there are tax elements. Talk about how some of your innovative products fit in there, and from a planning standpoint, walk us through the process. So
thank you.
Because this is what's on everybody's mind. Eventually, it's just, you know, sometimes day to day you don't really think about it that much because you're running your business. But this is long term planning or medium term planning that everyone should be doing, right?
Well, it's a great question because we never do this by ourselves. If we're working for a business owner, we usually get introduced to that business owner by his investment advisor, his legal advisor, his tax advisor. They know us through either some historically we've worked together or we have common clients or whatever. And the process, if we work with affluent families, you could almost say, why does an affluent family need life insurance? They've got lots of money. Well,
right.
They usually need life insurance because they have a business that's illiquid and they don't want to have to sell it when they die. They want to leave it to their children, or they just have very large estates and they have a big estate tax bill to pay.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's just quantitative. It's arithmetic to say, if you've got to pay $25 million in estate taxes, how do you want to pay that?
Right.
You know, you can take you can go to the bank and borrow $25 million if they'll loan it to you. You can liquidate $25 million of your investments, or you can buy life insurance and maybe pay $10 to $15 million to pay the tax rather than the total amount. But it is a combined effort. We don't make cold calls. We don't call on people. So for me to meet someone, that introduction has got to come through one of their other advisors.
So you're really coming alongside and joining with the team, so to speak, and then really being their advocate to the insurance world. And you know, how do you do that best?
Well, the planning process is first and foremost. We're going to do everything with the team of advisors to help someone do the most efficient job of estate planning they can do.
Mm-hmm.
So life insurance is going to be the very last piece of that puzzle. When you've done everything you can do to minimize the tax, enhance the transfer to the next generation, transfer the business down, whatever the objective is, and you say, okay, we've done everything we can do. Now we still have an estate tax of, pick a number, $11 million, $26 million, $5 million, whatever. How do we deal with that?
Mm-hmm.
And that's when the life insurance will come into play. So our recommendation is never going to be to you as a business owner, and then you go talk to your CPA or your lawyer to say, should we do this or what do you think about this? We want them to have been part of that process from day one.
Right. So. I guess quite a few years ago, you joined a larger network, M Financial Group.
We started it.
Excuse me, we were one of the
firms that started it.
Yes. Talk about how that's shaped your business as a, you know, over the years, I guess you've developed from a local to a regional to a national business, perhaps global now, but how does that network help you?
Well, when we started, the M Group was founded by four people whose either first name or last name started with M. And had we thought we were going to be reasonably successful, I think we would have done a better job of picking a name. We were something, you know, if you say the M Group, everybody looks at you like, what? but we started with five offices, and now we have 150 offices.
Wow.
So the power of those offices is what enables us to have power with insurance companies to say, if you will design product for us, then the volume that we can bring to you is bigger than your distribution system that now exists. And believe me, every life insurance company is interested in distribution.
Yeah. So that growth in that group has really has been you and the other people involved choosing some of the best insurance consulting companies around the country, around the world.
We have a couple in Europe, mm-hmm. But you know, 90%, 95% of our offices are here. And you're right; it's a selection process. We will find who are the people doing the best job in the insurance world in Boston, in New York, in Chicago, in Los Angeles, and approach those people and see if it's a fit. We're looking for corporate organizations. We're not looking for salespeople.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my office has 30 employees, five people like me who have account responsibility, and then another 25 support people. So, and that's exceedingly important to our advisor team, you know, when we do surveys to lawyers, accountants, investment folks to say, what do we do that you like? What do we do that we could do better? The high marks that we always get are service.
Mm-hmm.
If I call your office and I need something, it's there. You've got it online, on screen. I can get it instantly. I don't have to wait 2 weeks for an insurance company to send me some information. It's a little bit embarrassing that they don't think that our highest point is that we're good-looking and charming and smart mm-hmm. and thing. But that never gets a very high ranking with our survey.
So. Innovation is something that we talk a lot about here at the Founders Club. It's critical to everybody's business in some form or fashion. In the financial services business and the insurance side of things, innovation has been, there's been a lot of good innovation, a lot of innovation that ultimately kind of ends up as difficult. Talk about some of the innovative structures or things that you're developing or that you're utilizing on behalf of your clients these days.
Well, if I were really interested in locating a lot of creative, innovative people, I wouldn't go to insurance company home offices. That's not where they live.
Right.
And, you know, again, they're actuaries and everything's fact-based and quantitative. The innovation always has to come at local offices.
Right.
What do our clients want that they don't have? Mm-hmm. What can we create for them that they would want if they knew it were out there? So that the innovative, creative process is driven really by what's going on in the tax world, what's going on in the business world, what makes sense from an insurance standpoint, and mm-hmm. what we have to be careful of. If when we see new ideas, the new ideas will come in basically one of two forms. Usually some attempt by some outlier to develop some life insurance product that's tax deductible. That's been tried for 100 years.
Right.
Doesn't work. I mean, what you can see, if you see some strategy, one of the strategies that we've seen two of them in the last week, go borrow a lot of money. Let a bank loan you money. You deduct the interest, which probably can't happen in the first place. Buy a bunch of life insurance. Borrow the money at 3%. Invest the money in a life insurance policy at 6%. And, you know, you can stop that strategy and say, that works for anything.
Right.
Anytime I can borrow at 3% and invest at 6%, if you would guarantee me that spread. But that tax idea then usually somehow is followed by an inferior life insurance product
mm-hmm.
because nobody's looking at the product. They're just looking at the strategy or the idea. So innovation, let's put it this way, risky innovation is common. We see that often. Finding a new idea or a new strategy or a new technique that really works is difficult.
Right.
But, again, it's the lifeblood of our business. We have to be able to do things that other people can't do.
Well, that's really you've been on the forefront of that type of thoughtful innovation, I would call it, you know, for years and years and years. So one of the hallmarks of your firm. So thank you for that quick snapshot.
Thank you,
Scott. Tell us about East West and everything that you have going on there these days.
Sure. Well, we're a global high value contract manufacturing company, which is a complicated way for saying we make products for other companies. And our job is to manufacture products in those regions of the world that we think is most advantageous to our customers, where we can offer them the best combination of price, quality, and reliability. Started the company in 2001. I had been manufacturing products around the globe for 10 years prior to that. But we started 2001. It was a joint venture between a company here in Atlanta called Diversitech, and then myself and another partner. And today we are focused on, we have operations in China, here in the U.S., Vietnam, and India. And most of our customers are companies that, these are products that have complicated supply chains, a lot of engineering components to them, high tolerances and quality requirements. We like challenges like that.
Okay.
And the products we focus on, we like products that move air and water. So these are motors, pumps. We own a motor factory in China. We like high efficiency motors. There's a kind of a big shift in technology in motors today, where just like lighting moving to LED, motors are moving from being, I call them toaster ovens, at 20% efficiency up to 85% efficiency. And the cost used to be, you know, four or five times the normal price, but today it's coming down to being one to maybe two times the price. And so you're getting a big shift into high-efficiency motors. So we like products that move air and water. We do quite a bit in what we call industrial automation or robotics. That's a rapidly growing industry. We like electronic assemblies, circuit board assemblies. We have our own assembly operations in Vietnam. And then lastly is medical, is our medical instruments. That's our newest industry, and we've got a handful of products that we're developing there today.
And then you recently also made an investment in New Zealand as well,
yeah.
Correct? So a lot going on the other side of the world. Is that primarily driven by cost and expertise?
Well, what we're seeing
over there
in the world of manufacturing for the last 20 years, let me take a step back. When I started this business, there were regions of the world where you could certainly manufacture some products for less than others. We knew that. And a lot of times the issue was quality. I don't know if I can have a product made in China because they're not going to meet my quality requirements. And my philosophy was, well, it's not China that's the problem. It's the expectations and understanding of the processes and really of what the customer needs. And it's not like the factories in China were trying to produce bad products. They just didn't know what a good product was.
Right.
And really that's taking the definition of what the customer envisions, what their expectations are, and translating that into a way that the factories understand. And so that's how we got started. And I thought by bridging that gap, we could produce high quality products in regions, relatively undeveloped regions, and still achieve those kind of quality levels at a cost that you couldn't obtain elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And so we started that model, and it just grew from there. But now what's happened is over the last 20 years, we've seen this incredible development in China, where when I first started doing business there in the early 90s, an operator was earning as little as $300 or $400 a year, which is a lot of money in China, because most of the folks were at that point in time were living were in farming, and they were migrating the workers into the eastern region so that they could, because that was the only opportunity they had. Well, today the labor rates in China have gone up quite a bit. They're higher than Mexico in a lot of cases, higher than a lot of the developed countries. And so what you're finding is there's other regions of the world that can manufacture certain products for less than you can in China, which we think is a great opportunity. So Vietnam, for example, we set up an operation in Vietnam in 2003 because we knew all the rubber product materials were coming from Vietnam, going into China to get processed, and then getting shipped over to the U.S. And so we said, well, if the rubber's in Vietnam, why don't we just find a factory in Vietnam? And
so you're just taking out a step.
Right, but the challenge you run into in Vietnam is, well, they don't understand the expectation. It's not a developed. They don't have the engineering, the quality understanding, all those things. So we had to bring that to that rubber factory in China, in Vietnam, so that they could develop to the standards that the Chinese companies had already learned through. And if you look back in time, Japan went through this 40 years ago,
right?
Then Taiwan, then China, and in China, it was interesting how fast it developed because you had a lot of Hong Kong and Thai and Taiwanese companies that were setting up factories in China, and they spread that knowledge very quickly. And so our job is to continue to look around the globe and see where regions have specialization.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it comes down to raw materials. So, like I used the example of rubber for Vietnam. Well, we moved into India a couple of years ago because India has, in our mind, they have an advantage on metals, and so particularly stainless steel. And so we know today we can manufacture stainless steel products in India for less than probably anywhere else in the world.
Hmm.
And so we want to capitalize. That's arbitrage to us that we know that we can. So we have to figure out, well, how do we get the quality? How do we get the reliability? How do we set up the supply chain so that we can benefit our customers by producing their products in India at the lowest possible cost.
So, you're really combining expertise, location, and a process. Talk a little bit about, if I'm a customer of yours and just really at the front end of thinking about contract manufacturing versus doing it myself, how do you go about that? How do you start that process and, what's a typical cycle, I guess, for you?
Most of our customers, I wouldn't say most, but many are customers that tried to do this on their own.
Right.
And they realized that they just didn't have that expertise and those systems and processes in control to establish control. And you talked about innovation earlier, and that's really where we are extremely process-driven. We're an engineering company, right. And everything has processes around it. And we've developed some great tools internal to our organization for managing quality globally, for managing product development globally. You know, these are collaborative tools that have really good visuals on where we are in each milestone, so that we know at any given time where priorities stand, where key issues are, and who's responsible, all that sort of stuff. And if I were to show you these things, it would probably look like common sense in a lot of ways. But the way we've been able to pull these together so that we can get teams of groups to work effectively and very quickly on developing projects to our customers' expectations, that's really where the heart of what we do. And we've done a great job on the quality side as well.
So I guess by definition, a lot of your projects are somewhat short run, type of things where you're it would seem to me that you have to have a very nimble plant in that you have numerous products kind of coming down the road all the time.
Yeah, I mean, overall today we're producing, it's about 5,000 products that we manufacture globally. There's about 200 factories in China that are what we'd call qualified factories for East West. We've got a lot more that we've worked with that I would say are unqualified. And that's part of the process, right? You've got to know what factories are that you can work with and coach and are capable of producing to your standards. through that process, it's just like interviewing. You find a lot of factories that aren't ever going to fit that model. But there's 200 today that are making products for East West. In Vietnam, we've probably got 30 or 40. Most of East West's assets in terms of our fully owned structures we have three fully owned factories in Vietnam today, and that's turned into a really nice operation down there. Some of our products run, the way to make money in manufacturing is stability, and you want to make the same amount every single month.
Right. The longer the better, right?
Yeah, yeah. And for an extended period of time. Well, the reality is that doesn't happen a lot. Things are moving up and down, and you got to learn how to balance your workflows and your resources around that. We have some products that run quite well continuous, and then we have a lot like you brought up where we get one run and then we might not see it again for another year. Mm-hmm. And those are always tough. Mm-hmm. There's always new things that pop up and changes that happen, components that go obsolete, tools that start wearing down, et cetera. So it's there's a lot to keep track of.
I've got to ask, what's the craziest product you've ever had to manufacture?
Boy, there's a long list. There's a long list. In 2004, we took on too many inventors. What we've learned through this is that we typically run from inventors. And early on, it was when people knew what we were doing, they would say, "Oh, I've got an idea. My brother-in-law came up with the greatest thing, and I needed to help him make it."
Right.
And we took on about 9 or 10 of these things in 2004, and none of them. The best one we had was a microdermabrasion appliance that we developed in 2004, and it was kind of a take home or a home appliance that was mimicked after what's currently used by dermatologists. And American Telecast, who's the company that has George Foreman and Chuck Norris and Christy Brinkley, they had signed up Susan Summers to endorse this, and they were going to do an infomercial around it. And we were so excited, and I took American Telecast out to the factory and showed them how we were ready to gear this thing up, because they were projecting volumes that were through the roof. And just before we were getting into our run, we get a call from American Telecast saying that Susan has decided to drop out of this because she was too young to endorse what we at the time we thought were products for elderly women, right?
Right.
And so it fell apart. Well, it turned out that one of the partners in this organization ended up buying the rights to it, and about 3 or 4 years later, and he did a fantastic job marketing it, and we've got it into QVC now, and it was Neiman Marcus's Beauty Product of the Year last year, and it's done very well. I wouldn't say that was one of the craziest products we've made. I think the Poo Flicker probably still stands as the number one.
Poof liquor?
It's called the poof liquor.
Okay.
And it's instead of a scoop, it's like a golf shaft with a vision of golf shaft with a giant spatula on the end of it. And so instead of, you can just kind of move it around rather than picking it up. I think that wins the prize.
Yeah, that's a pretty good one.
One wins the prize. There's others,
but generally, as a rule, you stay away from the inventors.
Yeah, the industries and the companies that we get involved in are typically leaders in their industries. Like Diversitech in the air conditioning industry. In the robotics industry, we're teamed up with probably the premier robotics manufacturer for warehousing and logistics in the world. And we manufacture a lot of components for them. And material handling, same thing. We do a lot on terms of pallet flow and carton flow with one of the leaders in the industry. So we like being in a partnership relationship where they look at us like a department within their company, and anything that looks like it's a fit for our skill set, it just gets tossed over to us and we take it over for them.
Right. With employees all over the country, all over the world, how do you kind of ensure that your culture or the cultural cornerstones, I like to call them, get promoted or in all of your locations? Talk about that a little bit and what some of those are for East West.
Yeah, so we have our values like a lot of companies do, right. and ours is we really got it down in writing a few years ago, and that was really a challenge because I'd always thought we projected values, but getting that really down into the 9 or 10 things that are important to us was a challenge. Diversity is a big one mm-hmm. for us, and even if you look inside of just our East West office here in Atlanta, I think we have 700 employees globally. In Atlanta, it's just 35 in that range. The diversity within the 35 is unbelievable, and so we attract that kind of culture we're very respectful. No matter what region we're in, India, China, we make sure that we've got a management team that's local, and we try and incorporate whatever the cultures are of that particular area into the way we do business.
Mm-hmm.
Along with the processes and so on that's required to make the products. So we have an expat team. We've got a gentleman who's a key partner in the organization named Fritz who manages Asia, and he's a very interesting guy. He speaks a lot, 5 languages. He's one of these guys that, I think it was in the 80s, we added it up, something like 9 years that he spent on a bicycle traveling around the world.
Wow.
And I've done a couple bike trips with him, and it's just a fascinating guy to bike around with. And he's like a cultural expert, he just really knows how to understand what's important. And like in China, when we have really important negotiations, he's always the guy in the room that helps make sure things go in the right direction.
Interesting.
So in terms of other values, a lot of it is geared towards delivering on our commitments to our customers. Mm-hmm. Our business is very trusting oriented. A lot of times it's companies that are giving us their babies, and saying, you've got to make sure this is right, because if you don't get it right, we shut down.
Right.
And so the credibility that we have to have and the ability to come through on our commitments is paramount. And that speaks to a lot of what we have internally.
Mm-hmm. Mac, I'm going to shift back to you. Cultural cornerstones of your firm and things that you've really felt have been critical to the success of Nice Lagana.
Well, I think our commitment to education, we thought we really want to be different. Mm-hmm. And how do you differentiate yourself in a sales world where there are a lot of great marketers? I wouldn't tell you that we have one great marketer in our organization. We have some who are better than others. but we basically we want to work with other advisors and be part of an advisory team. We don't want to be treated like salesmen. We mm-hmm. won't act like salesmen. So when we hire someone, I'm thinking of a young guy that works directly with me now. He's a Georgia Tech undergraduate. He's got a master in business, master in tax, worked with a financial planning firm for 5 years. The guy's smart. And we owe that to our clients. The cultural cornerstone is if we accept somebody as a client, doesn't matter how big or how large, they're going to get the best that we have to offer. And we have insisted on that forever. Now, the last two hires that we have made, one is a lawyer, went to Michigan, worked with a law firm in Atlanta for a while, decided he didn't really want to do that for a living. He's been with us. And the last guy has had a 20-year experience in banking good businessman, lots of local knowledge. But culturally, it's always been, when we walk in a room, there's an expectation among other advisors, if you work with them for the first time, there's an expectation that the insurance guy in the room is the dumbest guy in the room. I mean, he's the salesperson. He's just here to get you to buy something. And our mission has been to say, we don't need to prove we're the smartest guy in the room. You know, usually if your attitude is such that I'm the smartest guy in the room, you'll soon be the only guy in the room.
Right.
But to say we can hold our own, mm-hmm. we know what you're talking about, we understand estate planning. I taught estate planning in graduate school for 10 years. And that's been it. And insurance companies respect us for that, because when we go to them with new product designs or new product pricing, they know first that as what you said, we'll deliver.
Mm-hmm.
If we tell you that this is what we're going to do, we'll deliver. And our clients know that we'll deliver. You know, there's a huge difference. When I say we only do one thing, and that's life insurance, if we do it in two spaces, one is a privately held company or in the estate planning space versus the large public company, those two functions don't even resemble each other in any way.
Mm-hmm.
The estate planning side, the private business side, is all about trust. It's all about making sure, you know, my family is taken care of, making sure we're doing the right things. They've worked with the same advisors for one generation, two generation, three generations. If I go to a public company to put an insurance program for 75 executives, I'm going to work with a CFO. I'm going to work with an HR person. That person's going to be different 2 years from now in both places. And it's just, one is nothing but business, quantitative, I want the most competitive thing I can find. The other is all about trust.
Right.
And our cornerstone has been that half knowledge is not worthy of trust.
Mm-hmm.
You either know what you're doing or you don't.
Good advice. Great advice. You both made the decision years ago now, and congratulations to both of you about the longevity of your businesses to start something new. Talk about the state of entrepreneurism these days, particularly here in Atlanta, but also, Scott, from your perspective on a global basis, since you operate in so many different markets. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah. I think it's alive and well.
Right.
going back to when I started my first company in Hong Kong when I was 28, and I did that because at the time I'd been in consulting for PricewaterhouseCoopers, and I got to see the insides of how a lot of these companies operated. And I thought to myself, well, geez, if these guys can be successful, you know, I got a chance, you know.
Right.
And so we've always tried to have that innovative and entrepreneurial culture. This investment you brought up in New Zealand, there was a company that we thought was kind of a cutting edge company in terms of technology, and I talked about advantages of certain regions. Well, it turns out that New Zealand has an advantage in having an R&D capabilities. There's a couple R&D centers that are over there, and you know, finding, particularly around industrial products, finding R&D, extremely technical folks here has been a challenge for us. And in New Zealand, I wouldn't say they're growing on trees, but it's easier to find.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're trying to move more into being a product development and design firm, using New Zealand as kind of our backbone for that, and all around the industries that I described earlier. We like teaming up with new and innovative companies globally, because we want to leverage those technologies. And there's just so much going on right now in terms of, particularly in the world of manufacturing, because you've got a lot of products that, you know, with the component pricing coming down and electronic, you know, it's the Moore's Law, right? Mm-hmm. Where the things can come down to a price where it can be, you can have a grocery cart now that talks to you, or a baby stroller that, you know, can run by itself, and you can do these things cost effectively with really good engineering. So it's really a lot of fun to get teamed up with these companies and reinvent technologies that hadn't been thought about for years. There's a company up in Boston called Four Moms, and I describe them as Dyson meets baby products. and they've just taken just some of the most, you know, like the baby swing, and they've reinvented that and turned it into a product that's incredibly innovative, using just technology that's just nobody had ever thought you could afford to incorporate into a product like this before. And so we like leveraging that because we can help them produce it for a cost that the market can obtain, which gives them better migration. Now we're not making that product yet, but I hope that's something that we can get to. But in robotics, it's the same way. Robotics, anybody can make a robot that's, you know, costs a lot of money, hundreds of thousands of dollars, that does one thing. But to get it to a price point where it can be sold globally at a competitive price, that requires a lot of thought and engineering. And so we really get excited about those types of opportunities.
That's that partnering with entrepreneurs, with, you know, the innovation centers has got to be just fascinating.
Yeah.
Mac, your thoughts on, you know, starting your business these days and entrepreneurism here in Atlanta?
Well, I'll separate a couple things. First of all, entrepreneurism here in Atlanta, to me, is incredible. I've been on various boards over at Georgia Tech for years, and their ATDC Center, I mean, what they're doing, some of it's almost fairyland kind of stuff when they tell you.
Right.
One of the things that most people don't know, I mean, more than 50% of Georgia Tech's budget comes from research, and a huge amount of that comes from the Department of Defense. Now, it's very hard to find out what they're doing.
Right.
They don't want to tell you. But, you know, we have some very young clients who have done extremely well with very unusual kind of things. I mean, I realize it's, a lot of this is generational, because I look at that and somebody said, if they had brought that to you 10 years ago, would you have invested in that? And I would, you know, to be honest, you'd say, no. I mean, that's got no chance. And, you know, one of the things you watch after years of being a business is there's usually a disconnect between creativity and execution. Mm-hmm. There's some people who are enormously creative. They've always got a great idea. They're inventive, but they can't execute. I mean, you've got to marry something there. So we find that in most of the successful entrepreneurial companies, unless it's just a Google, a Facebook, or whatever way you say, unbelievable results at the end, but who thought so at the beginning? You don't find, in my particular industry, you don't find a lot of entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. You don't find a lot of interest. I made a talk to a national group the other day, and I had the Life Insurance Marketing Research Association do give me some statistics. And 25 years ago, the average age of a life insurance agent in America was 36 years old. 25 years later, the average age of a life insurance agent is 56 years old.
Wow.
So it's aged 20 years and 25, which basically nobody's coming in this business.
Yeah.
And that's a little bit of an overstatement, but not much. Our competition today, if we like to say we don't have any, I mean, we never compete with an insurance agent from, banks are in the insurance business. Brokerage houses are in the insurance business. CPA firms are in the insurance business. I mean, the people who have trusted client contact are successful in the life insurance business. The information flow today, for young insurance salesmen, I came in the insurance business when I was 21 years old, and obviously I had no intention of staying in the insurance. This was just a holding pattern while I got a couple graduate degrees and got a real good job. But I could make a living then. I couldn't make a great living, but I could make a living. A young guy today coming in insurance can't make a living.
Right.
You know, $1 million of term insurance, if somebody's 30 years old and got $1 million of term insurance probably costs $300.
Yeah.
So the guy's going to make $100. And he's got to meet with him five times to sell it. I mean, the numbers aren't there.
Doesn't work.
So you've got to work with large companies. You've got to work with wealthy families. You don't get to do that when you're young.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't see many insurance agents who come up like we did, who work with an insurance company for a while and say, there's a better way to do this. We're going to go out on our own and start something, because it's expensive.
Right.
You know, I got 30 people I've got to pay. If I worked as an agent for somebody, I wouldn't pay anybody. They'd pay them. So, again, from the entrepreneurial world of who our clients are, big, booming, interesting, fun to talk to them, sit down, watch the energy. I used to work, do a lot of work with a consulting company to the construction industry called Fales Management Institute, started by Doc Fales. And I used to kid him, and I thought, if you can have a successful consulting firm with the name Fales in the title, I mean, that takes courage. But Doc Fales was about 65 years old, and all the rest of us who were working with him as consultants and educators were 35. And one of the pieces of advice Doc would always say, so you've got to surround yourself with bright young people. They'll keep you young. They'll keep you interested. And I find that. Mm-hmm. I mean, and some of our young entrepreneurial clients, you sit down with them and you think, I'm old enough to be their father. And some of the stuff they're doing is unbelievable to me. And their new ideas, I'm skeptical. And you think, I guess I can't help but be skeptical, but it's working. Right. These guys are good.
Yeah. So. That's great. Both of you have critical elements of your business that are collaboration with outside firms. Talk about some tips for people who are trying to maximize partnerships. Mac, in your instance, your work with M Financial and other insurance carriers. Scott, in your world with literally other manufacturer providers who you're interacting with. Thoughts on that, you know, because so much of the world is becoming collaborative now instead of just doing it yourself.
You know, we were talking earlier about, selling to our customers, and what we're finding with, in our space is that our customers don't want to be sold to. They want to be educated, and they want to know that they're working with folks that understand what their needs are. Mm-hmm. We've done a lot. Many of our customers now, interestingly enough, are also our competitors. And we've just, the companies like Flextronics and J-Bill are leading organizations in the contract manufacturing space. And they've partnered with us because they see that we have an area of expertise that maybe they don't. Maybe mm-hmm. they don't have operations in Vietnam that can do what we need to do, or even some of the big global companies that we work with, they want us to take on maybe their metal machining because they don't have that expertise in house to do it internally. And so we're really able to, as we get more and more specialized, we can get closer to them in terms of what they look to us for in terms of skill set. And so I see that continuing to evolve as we grow. And it's interesting. I've learned a lot about. It seems like in terms of the trusting sell that we have to put out there, we're doing a lot more in terms of trying to be the industry experts and blogging on things that, you know, that we're seeing in our space. And that just earns us credibility with our customers. And I learned this the other day on the internet. Somebody Googles, what does it cost to make my product 140,000 times a month, right? So what a great opportunity for us to put an expert opinion out there in terms of what does it cost to make your product.
Right.
And that'll just earn us more credibility in the space.
So expertise, specialization are really driving that credibility, which helps with the collaboration with big companies and with smaller companies.
Exactly. Great.
Mac, thoughts over the years about collaboration and working with other firms.
Well, in our world, it's necessary.
Yeah.
And the first thing you learn is you can't be greedy. I mean, it's the client's best interest is always out there first. We do a good bit of joint work with other insurance agents. Mm-hmm. And they'll call us and say, we're working, and would you help us? I'd have to say at best, we are now smart enough to weed things out early on. Mm-hmm. To say, what agenda do you have? Often their agenda is, I want to place it with my company. Mm-hmm. And we say that may not work. I want this, I want that, I want the other. And I thought, I haven't heard anything yet that makes me interested in working with you. I mean, it's all about you. It's not about the client. It's not about, what expertise do we really have? You just want us to help you sell something and then get out of the way. We're not interested in transactions. We're right. interested in relationships. And if we can be someone's insurance advisor, and whether that someone is a big law firm, whether that someone's an accounting firm, whether it's somebody like PwC who calls on us for certain things, those are the kind of relationships and partnerships you want. I was interviewed not long ago, and somebody said, you guys have been together for 28 years. What are you proudest of? And I said, probably that we're still together after 28 years. Because we're partners. I mean, yeah. we run a corporate enterprise. We don't pay people individual sales deals. But when you have a professional practice, the income that comes in is very transparent. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows where it came from, who brought it in, how it got there, and everybody knows who takes what home. Right. So if you're greedy, these things won't usually last mm-hmm. very long. So there has to be an external focus to say, we are much better off together. Our clients are much better off because we are together. Mm-hmm. And that includes not only the internal structure in the firm, but the relationships we have with, you know, if you were to refer me a client, the thing that that we stress is, what we know is that client is much more important to you than it is to us. You have a long-term relationship there. You're taking a risk at bringing us in. We are not going to do anything that would make you sorry you brought us in. We're going to make sure that client is happy about everything, and we're going to make sure we touch base with you all along the way to say, this is what we think. What do you think? I mean, partnerships are difficult. Yeah. And they're often put together. In the life insurance business, we used to laugh because what you'd find is two life insurance people with the same insurance company. One is a great salesman and one's a good design person inside. So they would get together and they would be Mr. Inside and Mr. Outside. And I thought that last successful Mr. Inside and Mr. Outside were the two running backs at Army in 1940. because somebody will be more responsible for income than somebody else. And right. usually that person, you know, think about how many law firms you know that at the end of the year, there's a new law firm.
Right.
You know, somebody said, well, look, I'm the divorce lawyer. I brought in $2 million. You're the whatever. You brought in $500 and we make the same thing. And then, you know, I think I can do better on my own.
Breaks off.
Yeah. yeah so.
I was going to add there, John, with respect to collaboration, one of the things we're seeing where the strongest relationships and partnerships we have tend to have more transparency associated with us and them. So in many of our big accounts, we have pure transparency in terms of what our cost structures are. We'll provide them with listed bills and materials that show what each component costs, how much we're layering in for ourselves. And we often negotiate that up front with a supply agreement. And once that's in place, it's wonderful because there is no negotiating anymore. It is what it is. And then it's out there and they feel like they're getting a fair price. And then we just move on from there. And I think at this point, probably 80% of our revenue is probably under that sort of a structure. Hmm. And I want to accelerate that because that speaks to the trust sale. Everybody wants to know they're getting a good deal, and the more transparent we are, the more they understand what's out there and the value that we're providing. And I could see a situation where we just approach companies, just say, "Well, you know, we'll show you everything. We'll show you all our costs, and you show us what you're paying for things, and we'll just work together to see how we can try and offer you the best savings achievable."
Yeah.
And that fosters a lot of credibility.
I think that's a great point because I think the less transparent you are, the more suspicious the guy on the other side of the table is. You know, it used to frustrate me so badly when insurance products were, go back 30 years, they were much more complicated in terms of trying to figure out, if I put my money in here, what rate of return do I get on my money? Mm-hmm. That ought to be a very simple answer, and it wasn't.
Right.
And you couldn't calculate it unless you calculated it backwards or you went out 20 years. And I thought, you know, when I tell somebody and they say, what am I earning on this? And I say, I don't know.
Right.
He's got to have one of two thoughts. Either this guy's not very smart, he can't figure out what the rate of return is, or number two, he knows and he won't tell me.
Right.
So one of the things we did with insurance companies is to say, let's bifurcate all of these products and say, here's the rate of return paid on the money. Here's the charge for the insurance. Here's the state premium. Here's everything. So I can put it in front of him and say, here it is. You know, we make X. A lot of this, you know, you pay this, right, and here's where all the money goes. And
yeah,
somebody can say, well, I don't like the fact that Georgia charges a 2% state premium tax. And I can say, well, I don't like it either because it sure doesn't help me any at all. But
it's part of the cost.
That's part of the cost.
Yeah, transparency is really kind of across the board, I think, helped business rather than...
A lot of people are afraid of it,
but some of the best and most successful companies are embracing it, like both of you are. Every time I have to ask what the best business advice you ever received was. This is on the heels of an incredible amount of insight from both of you already, so it may have maybe boiled into a question that you've already answered. But
I'd love to give you a real simple answer. I'd like to separate two pieces of advice I got by time, and I really want to do that three ways, three pieces. I grew up in a town of 800 people. My grandfather started a service station there. My dad came back from World War II and enlarged it into a nice tire business and on and on and on. But I had the great fortune as a teenager of working with my father and my grandfather, and they were very different people. My grandfather had a seventh grade education. And I don't know what was going on one day at the service station, but I was obviously telling somebody how to do something. And my grandfather came over to me after that person had left, and he said, son, I just want to tell you something. And I said, what? He said, people don't want your advice when they ask for it, and they sure don't want it when they don't ask for it. And I have never forgotten that. I have a great friend who was the president of not the CEO of Invesco, but president of one of Invesco's division. The first thing he's going to say to you is, I got some advice for you. He's going to tell you how to run a certain part of your business, and you think, don't you think he knows how to do that better than you do? But he can't help himself. So I have learned often when I hear things, and I think John's just wrong about that, or I have to think, okay, let's sit on that for a while. John got to that position in his life. Well, for example, there's no one you will ever meet who doesn't have some kind of emotional position about life insurance. You know, if you ask somebody something about what do you think the yield's going to be on municipal bonds in 18 months, they might look at you and say, I don't have a clue what you're talking about. But ask them a life insurance question, and they know more than I know. I mean, you just get accustomed to that. So I've learned to keep my advice to myself until it's appropriate to say, here's some recommendations I have. Secondly, when I was young, I had a mentor who said to me, the most important thing you can do is invest in yourself. And, you know, other people are looking for, they want to invest in stocks or bonds, or they want to, you know, buy some business. But he said, you know, get yourself educated, spend money building your own business. The other stuff will come later. And I thought one of the things that I've seen in my career in the life insurance business is a reluctance for people to invest in themselves, to go out and do something on their own. It's a lot easier to stay as an employee of an insurance company where they're paying your rent, paying your secretary, and I think there's no growth there. Mm-hmm. You know, I interviewed a young guy who was working for an insurance company, and he said, you know, the training program, he said, I have to have 15 appointments a week. And, you know, how many telephone calls do you have to make to get 15 appointments? You know, 100, 150, I don't know. But I thought, if you have 15 appointments a week and you have to do all the work to get there, how do you spend any time working on the appointments you had? I mean, what can you do for somebody when you got three appointments? There's no possible growth there.
Right.
And so invest in yourself. And then the third piece that I just say is the advice that I've listened to so much as I've gotten older is surround yourself with young people, young, mm-hmm, smart people, and leave them alone and watch them. I've had the pleasure of being president of certain organizations, and you know, they sometimes, especially if they're not for profit, if they're a university, if they're some of the, they don't like to let you go, and right, they don't like to let you go for some couple of time obvious reasons. One is old people have more money and they're more likely to give money. Secondly, you know, they can count on you to do things, and I basically say, when asked by those, I've done that, and you got some really bright young people out there who deserve the opportunity to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Let them do it.
Right.
And let, you know, let me sit in the chair and drink a cup of coffee.
That's great. Thank you, Mac. You know. Appreciate it.
So what Max said about investing yourself, that was I had two as well. When I was in my early 20s, I had been a manufacturing engineer for a company that became Boston Scientific, but making medical instruments. And then I got an opportunity, an offer, in fact, to sell hip and knee replacements. And the compensation was, in my early 20s, was through the roof. I mean, it was like four or five times what I had been making. And then I also had another opportunity to be a supply chain consultant for PricewaterhouseCoopers. And I remember sitting down with my father on this and saying, well, Dad, I can make so much money on this orthopedic sales position. And he said, you know, it's not about the money in your 20s. It's about the experience. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what you can learn in as a consultant is so much more valuable in the long run than what you could do in the sales position. And I always remember that, you know, and thinking, gee, turning down that opportunity was tough, but in the long run,
but you effectively laid the foundation for the rest of your career.
Yeah, I mean, every position I took layered on top of the next in terms of my experience and then willingness to go out and start my own business in my late 20s. And then the other thing that I remember, and this was experience that I had when I was working in this company it was in Miami, making these medical instruments. These guys came, they invented disposable, minimal invasive surgical equipment. And they had reusable instruments in the market, but nobody had done disposable before. And they got the patents on this idea, and they said, the decision was, do we create our own distribution on this, or do we license it out to folks that have established distribution channels? And they chose the latter. They went to Ethicon and Boston Scientific at the time, and they licensed their technology. And these companies had enormous sales departments, and all they did is just put their product in their portfolio, and they went out and sold millions and millions of these things overnight. For them to have done that themselves, to created their own distribution, just would have taken infinitely longer and more money. And so when I was sitting down with the guy, the owner of the business, he said, we do not want to create our own distribution. Mm-hmm. We want to leverage somebody else's because it can happen so much faster. And that's, I've always given that advice to other people, especially inventors that want to make something and then figure out how to sell it. Do not have to get the patent, find somebody already selling it, and license it.
Right.
Because you'll be much more successful in the long run. And that's been true with our business as well. We like to find companies that have significant distribution. And when you develop a product for somebody that has that, the chances of success are so much higher right. than them thinking that they got to go out and create distribution themselves.
Mm-hmm. Really have enjoyed our conversation today. Some great advice and wisdom from both of you. I'm so thankful for it. Mac, how can people, our listeners, learn more about your firm?
I guess
or contact
traditional
you.
Ways, they can contact me or anybody at the firm. There's a web, the website. We have all the traditional ways of doing that. So we have great referral sources who are very willing if someone says, can you give me some names of some other people you have worked with? We never give our clients' names, but we will give law firms or accounting firms or other advisors to say these people have worked with us for a long time.
Great.
Call them.
Okay. So, thank you. Scott, website?
Yeah, we got all the traditional stuff, the website, and you can call me. My phone number's on the internet and the website, so I'm happy to sit down and talk to anybody about what we do and how we can help them.
Fantastic. Again, thank you both. This has been great. Join us again next week for another Founders Club broadcast sponsored by Atlantic Capital Bank and powered by Business Radio X.